This week, Pakistan's Prime Minister crossed the Middle East, meeting with regional powers Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Turkey, with a view to securing a second round of peace talks between Iran and the US. But one regional player was notably absent, the United Arab Emirates. Indeed, our next guest says that the Iran war has prompted a profound crisis for the UAE. Colin Powers is from the Paris-based independent research non-profit Noria Research. He recently wrote the essay, The Emirates on the Tightrope. Colin, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I wonder if we could start with a bit of a primer about what the United Arab Emirates actually is. I think everyone's familiar with the name, but could you sort of describe the historic and current power relations at the core of the UAE?
Sure. The UAE currently is a federation of seven emirates, all of which maintain a high degree of autonomy in governing their internal affairs. But through custom, the Federal Supreme Council appoints a president for the entire federation and a prime minister. And the president is habitually and historically the emir of Abu Dhabi, whereas the prime minister is the emir of Dubai. Between 1820 and 1971, these Trukial states, as they were then referred, were a protectorate of the British Empire. They were awarded, with some reluctance on all parties, for all parties, their independence thereafter. And in the subsequent period, you know, retained quite close relations to the United Kingdom in terms of security, in terms of investment and trade and everything else. But over the years, certainly moved to a new imperial protector, and that was the United States.
You mentioned Dubai and Abu Dhabi. They're probably the most well-known emirates. Could you describe a little bit more for us the dynamic between the rulers of Dubai and Abu Dhabi and who really has the most control?
Yeah, so historically, as the two largest economies by far within this seven emirate federation, Abu Dhabi and Dubai kind of had a balance, particularly in governing external affairs. So when it came to foreign policy, each party very much had to weigh the interests, outlook, ideological kind of perspective of the other. And under the founder of the UAE, which is Zayed, the UAE generally adopted a rather light footprint when it came to foreign policy. So they recognized that Saudi Arabia was the dominant player in the Arab Gulf, and they kind of just fell in line and were more of a backseat actor. Things changed as the generations turned over. And so Mohammed bin Zayed really arrived on the scene in the mid-2000s with his five maternal brothers, and they're called the Bani Fatima. And Mohammed bin Zayed has a much more grandiose perspective, perhaps, on the role his country could play. And he was enabled to kind of advance his interests, his vision for the UAE as a foreign policy actor after the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009. And the reason for that was that Dubai went bankrupt. And they ended up having to borrow $20 billion in total, if you include central bank deposits, from Abu Dhabi. And thereafter, Dubai de facto had to cede their voice when it came to foreign policy. And so it's in this next kind of 15-year window that we see the UAE adopt a much more aggressive posture in intervening in a number of foreign theaters. And this period corresponded with the rise of Mohammed bin Zayed, corresponded with the Arab Spring, which was a major impetus for them choosing this course of action. But very significantly, it also corresponded with this bankruptcy of Dubai, which rendered Dubai sort of a dependency, in a way, of Abu Dhabi.
Colin, in your essay, The Emirates on the Tightrope, you describe the UAE as being built on three foundation stones, all of which are now suddenly under threat because of the war with Iran. Could you talk us through those foundation stones?
Yeah, well, I think if you try to understand the political economy of the UAE in general, it really centers on petroleum rents for Abu Dhabi. And in the case of Dubai, it centers on this idea that it was a safe haven, right? And it was a place where the wealthy of the world could go and park their money, be it in financial centers, which are kind of like Hong Kong and many of these other entrepôt offshore, no tax, high privacy zones. You could put assets in there. You could quite famously put it into the property market, where we've seen a lot of the more gray and black market actors target for wealth preservation purposes. And it's also, you know, a major trading center. It's kind of a hub between Asia, Africa, and Europe. And so if you look at like the re-exports, meaning exports that transit through the ports of Jebel Ali, which is in Dubai, or the ports in Abu Dhabi, we were talking about huge amounts of volume. Even the global aid economy really runs through Jebel Ali. And so it's kind of this nexus point in the global economy, which also at an underlying level relies on the enormous revenues that Abu Dhabi generates from petroleum products and Dubai's ability to attract capital inflows into its property market and into its financial market.
Yeah, so oil rents, open seas, elite sanctuary. And then when you think about what's happened since the US and Israel invaded Iran, it's exactly those three things which seem to have been hit very, very hard. On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Colin Powers from Noria Research, who's written the essay, The Emirates on the Tightrope. Colin, I wonder if we could speak now a little bit more about that shift in foreign policy of the UAE and its quest for regional, saying it's difficult to overstate how much suffering their project for regional dominance has caused. What are some of the key examples you cite in support of those conclusions?
Well, I think in the earliest days of the Arab uprisings, which really kick off at the end of 2010, the UAE was to play a very central role, initially backstage, in disrupting and rerouting the democratic transition in Egypt. And so they financed some of the opposition movements and the relation between the army and the opposition movements, which ended up bringing down the government of Mohamed Morsi. And they did so in this instance for two primary reasons. Mohammed bin Zayed himself has a deep ideological rejection of both the alternative that the Muslim Brotherhood sought to establish and model for the Arab world and for Muslim countries more generally, which is an idea of sort of a socially conservative but procedurally democratic state. And in many ways, they were angling in something that resembled the Christian Democratic Party in Europe. And for a dynastic monarchy, as Abu Dhabi is, obviously that presented a threat. Adjacent to that would be an ideological rejection of people's rule, of democracy. So I think that inspired the interventions, which were quite significant, first in disrupting the democratic transition in Egypt and subsequently in underwriting the Sisi government for the next 15 years, most recently through $35 billion investment into tourism assets, which really saved Egypt from financial crisis just a few years ago. It just the injection of hard currency kept the Egyptian pound from falling even into more dire straits. Of course, UAE, like many of the other Gulf players, was very involved in Syria, prominently in Libya in backing Khalifa Haftar. He attempted to seize the entire territory of Libya, but it remains the power in the east where much of the oil resources are. In Sudan, of course, they have backed the rapid support forces of Dagalo Hamerti, whose war crimes at this point are documented everywhere from the UN down to, local journalism, international journalism. Yemen, alongside Saudi initially with a very heavy aerial campaign, but subsequently to that, they were backing secessionist movements in the south and had a significant military presence to advance that. They were, at the start of this year, driven out of Yemen after Saudi, in fact, targeted some of their local proxies, but they remain retaining a military facility on an island called Socotra, or actually a series of islands, which it is believed that they maintain an intelligence base there and share it with the Israelis.
What about the UAE's relations with Iran, Colin? Because I understand that the UAE has always seen Iran as a threat, but at the same time has not supported robust action against Iran. Could you perhaps talk us through that history and the rationale for it?
Yeah, I think this is one of the contradictions which are always present in history and in our current moment. Dubai especially has been the lifeline for the Iranian economy since the U.S. sanctions regime really intensified. It's in Dubai that they've been able to park a lot of their financial wealth and keep it outside the reach of U.S. Treasury Department. It's often been through Emirati ports that Iran has been able to import a lot of the goods that sustain their own consumer and industrial economy. And it's historically through Fujairah that some of Iran's oil was also going out to market. The same port played a critical role in refining Russian crude after 2022 in order to keep oil on market despite, you know, the West's very public announcements that they were targeting Russian oil production. So, yeah, there's always been this material reality where there's a very close relation between the two economies. I mean, they're right next door. It only makes sense that there would be. And these relationships between merchant families and between, you know, traders and financiers in both countries go back a really long time, you know. And so it's not surprising that that retains a life even through today, and an enormous amount even of the UAE's fruits and vegetables have been coming from Iran in recent years.
Yes, I was amazed by those statistics. You're right that 90% of UAE's tomatoes, cauliflower and watermelons, as well as large shares of cucumbers, lettuce and eggplant have come from Iran.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, the UAE makes a very big point of emphasizing food security, which is a challenge in a climate and in a broader ecological environment as they live in. But the reality is they're highly, highly dependent on a potential adversary beyond grains, essentially for the foodstuffs that feed their own people. One of the other curiosities of that is that in opening their market to Iranian producers who can produce all of these products at a much cheaper level than can Emirati agricultural firms, they've kind of undermined their own domestic farming sector. And I guess one other thing worth pointing out is that many of the wholesale traders who are bringing in Iranian goods, those firms are actually controlled by the royal family of Abu Dhabi. So they're making money on deepening their country's food dependence on a notional adversary while undermining their own agricultural sector. These are one of the many kind of striking contradictions of the moment.
Yeah. So on the one hand, it seems that the UAE was acutely conscious of the potential for conflict in Iran to affect it adversely. But at the same time, you describe the leadership of the UAE as also very shocked by what's happened since the invasion. Could you talk us through that also, what appears to be potentially a bit of a contradiction?
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that I found notable, and it can happen not just with the UAE, but with any kind of political class. I think when there's a relatively steady progression across a relatively lengthy period of time.
I remember those old days, yeah.
Yeah, people can end up assuming that the status quo will just reproduce itself. And you can attach yourself to certain truisms and certain kind of assumptions of the way things will go henceforth. So the UAE, the assumption was, we remain in the American century. And so by signing on to the Abraham Accords and by purchasing tens and billions in dollars of armaments from the United States and by recycling our own petroleum wealth into the AI companies and the broader Silicon Valley ecosystem of the United States, well, then the global hegemon that is the United States will see to it that our security is maintained ad infinitum. And it will see to it without requiring a kinetic challenge, right? Because you would have assumed if you're sitting in Abu Dhabi, you would know that a kinetic war with Iran was going to imperil your own country almost immediately. You're not Israel, who remains within the reach of ballistic missiles, but, you know, quite far away from Iran. You're literally right next door, and as we've seen, can be just overwhelmed with drones at any moment of Iran's choosing. And so I think, though this seems very obvious in hindsight, they were operating based on the assumption that the existence of American power and the threat that that generates for a country like Iran, a threat that is generally maintained, not to say Iran hasn't intervened elsewhere, not to say that the United States has not engaged Iran in different theaters, but the ubiquitousness and dominance of American power was such that in aligning yourself with that camp, there would be certain lines in the sand that wouldn't get crossed, and ultimately the royal family's interests would be protected and their control over the country. And so I think this has been a rather kind of stark refutation of all that had been assumed. And it seems to me that they are really struggling to recognize where they sit right now, because the world that they knew and the world that they assumed would persist has turned out to be so vastly different from the world that is.
Yeah, you describe it as a crisis and a challenge, which is really sort of existential for the UAE. Do you think that there are signs of a strategy from the UAE leadership of a way out of this or some other viable way out of it?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's important to recognize how essential the UAE has made itself to the functioning of the global economy. And that means for China, for the United States, for Africa, for the Middle East, the capital markets of the country are critical to funding businesses from all over. China runs a ton of their investments through the Dubai International Financial Center. So given that everyone is staked in the UAE, one can imagine there's enough interest in the country's reproduction, survival, prosperity, that it won't just be swept into the dustbins of history. At the same time, you know, at least publicly, and this is one of the reasons they've been excluded from the negotiations, they've taken a very bellicose line, in a line very close to Tel Aviv, in that they've mostly been pushing for an expansion of this war. The reasoning here is befuddling, because expansion almost necessarily will bring extreme levels, even existential levels of damage to the UAE. I don't see a world where an American land invasion or a kind of international coalition trying to take the strait back would not lead to major destruction of infrastructure in the UAE. And given how precarious having dense urban life in a desert climate is, those kinds of attacks on infrastructure will render the place unlivable within weeks. And so I don't think their leadership is doing themselves any favors in how they're playing this. You can contrast that with Qatar, with Saudi, who I think ultimately recognize some kind of arrangement needs to be found with Iran for anybody to have a future here. Some kind of more stable politics needs to be established. And I think the UAE, because of its proximity and closeness to the Israeli camp, perhaps because of the extreme concentration of power, which is, we're really talking about five brothers and, you know, the handful of advisors they bring around them, I don't think they're really recognizing where they sit right now.
And you finish your New York Review of Books essay, Colin, by describing the impressive cities of the Emirates as cities built on sand. Colin, it's been fascinating speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Colin Powers is from the Paris-based independent research nonprofit Noria Research, and his essay in the New York Review of Books is The Emirates on the Tightrope.